it occurred to me as I was coming out here that tomorrow I'm going to do this documentary. It's actually for the Scottish BBC, and it's on the Scottish roots of the Klan. And it occurred to me that as a Presbyterian church, there may be some in here who have Scottish roots themselves, and so would be interested in that. And it was funny because a few months ago, the Scottish BBC people called me and they said, "We're doing this show on, we're going to do this documentary on the Scottish roots of the Klan. I wonder if you could contribute." And I said, "I don't think there are any Scottish roots to the Klan, like except." I said, "Well, there is, there's this." You know, I started talking. I was like, "Oh, there's a lot of Scottish roots to the Klan." It actually hadn't occurred to me. So it'll be a really interesting documentary. It's Sir Walter Scott, you know, is the originary idea. And then a lot of the people who were involved in it early on were Scottish, which I just hadn't noticed, right? Because I wasn't thinking about Scottish people. But yeah, so that'll be interesting. Thank you, David, for inviting me out. This was, it's always a pleasure to come out here. So I will go ahead and get started. David invited me out to talk about my new book, which is this guy, Ku Klux, the Birth of the Klan During Reconstruction. I worked on this book for 13 years, and it finally came out, so I'm ready to stop spending time with it and start moving to another probably equally depressing topic. Actually it is, unfortunately. So what I want to do, I instead of just talking through the book, I decided to do it thematically, five things that you have probably misunderstood about the Klan, and that'll be more kind of tying it in, just bringing it up a little bit more to the present, historically, talking about some of the later Klan things, but a lot of themes that are developed in the book. So this is kind of the, do people hear a kind of a funny squeal? Okay. If I need to, I can project pretty well without this. Okay, so we will get started. Okay, so here is the book.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's even better. Sometimes the old technology works better. Yes. Yeah, I'd even autograph it. Okay, how about that? And I've just brought a handful of them out here, but I have a whole bunch in the trunk of my car. Like I said, I feel like a traveling salesman. I'm like out there. Just in case we have a run on the book. I am prepared for that. Let's see. Okay, so what we're going to do is just run through five different myths about the Ku Klux Klan. And the first one, the Klan has existed since it was founded 150 years ago. Okay, the Klan was founded, and that's one reason why the book is coming out when it is, and you know why there's a lot of interest in the Klan right now. The Klan was founded 150 years ago. Actually, probably 150 years ago exactly. Okay, the Klan was founded in, maybe not down to the day, but what we know about the founding of the Klan, it was founded in 1866, and it was founded in either May or June of 1866. So we're at the 150th anniversary, and wisely, I think, you know, everybody decided not to make a huge deal out of it, though I sometimes wonder if the current resurgence of the Klan is not completely disconnected from that, that anniversary. So the Klan was started in May or June of 1866, and it was started in Pulaski, Tennessee, which is a small town in Tennessee, small-ish town in Tennessee. It was not super rural. It was connected to Nashville by a train already, and so it was pretty easy to get back and forth to Nashville, and it was There was some stuff going on. They had a newspaper, they had some lawyers, they had some business there. It wasn't a super poor town or anything like that, right? And it wasn't really plantation country either, right? And the people who founded the Klan were, none of them were slave owners. One of them had a slave. But basically they were lawyers, newspaper editors,
one of them is going to become an insurance salesman, right? They were people who had been young men who had fought in the Civil War as Confederates, and they had all been kind of low-level officers. They were educated for their time and place. Most of them had some sort of college that they'd gone to, which was very unusual at the time, which put them in the elite. So they were the most educated young men from that area, kind of the professional class of like future leaders of Pulaski, right? So six of them got together, and politically, we won't get into this, but politically, they weren't particularly conservative, right? These same people who were going to become the Klan founders, we know that at least some of them had objected to secession until very late, until actually after secession occurred, after their state left, they joined and then fought, you know, and totally changed their perspective of things, like a lot of people did, right? So these weren't particularly, you know, kind of hayseed people. They weren't particularly right-wing people. But after the Civil War, they're going to get together, and they're going to form. We have, okay, this is very likely them. Okay, and so this is, we can't be absolutely sure, but this was a picture that was found in the Giles County, Tennessee Historical Society. Giles County is where the Pulaski is in Giles County. And their historical society has this collection of old images and stuff like that in their public library. So this was in the Pulaski, the back of the Pulaski Public Library. You open up like a little manila folder, and there is this image which was called the Midnight Rangers. It said Midnight Rangers on the back of it. Midnight Rangers, 1866. 1866 year the Klan was founded. What Rangers are at the time, if anybody is a Civil War historian, you know, or aware of, you know, read a lot of the Civil War history, what the Rangers are is sort of semi-legal affiliates of the Army. Right. So the Rangers were groups of men who went out and didn't fight on battlefields, but engaged in guerrilla warfare or sort of more marginal forms of warfare. Right. So these guys were called the Midnight Rangers, 1866. And if you look, they are playing musical instruments. The reason we feel pretty confident that this is the Klan is that when we have a list of the names of the people who started the Klan, and we have some images of them, and you can map the specific people onto the faces, you know, we can say, oh, this must be Frank McCord, you know, this must be this guy, this must be this guy. So these are the founders of the Klan, and particularly the guy in with the black fiddle sitting in the front row with the beard, that is Frank McCord, who was by far the most important person in starting the Klan. I believe that he may have dreamed up the whole thing, right, and kind of, you know, come up with it and come up with the rituals and started talking about it. And he was also the editor of the newspaper called the Pulaski Citizen. And so he and his brother were the editors of the newspaper. And they started saying, oh, there's this Klan, and it does this, and it does that. And, you know, we had a ghost show up and tell us about it last night. And so they started developing with these regular newspaper articles a story about this Klan. The stories didn't start coming out until 1867. Nobody else actually knew about the Klan or saw the Klan do anything until, so the stories start coming out in April of 1867. Nobody else encounters the Klan or knows anything about the Klan or is afraid of the Klan until late 1867, right? And so they start talking about it long before anybody else sees any Klan's people or complains about any Klan's people. And then when you ask people in town, when you ask freed people in Pulaski, when did you first hear about the Klan? They say, oh, early 1868. Okay, so the Klan was something that kind of starts in this newspaper and gradually grows into a thing that is real, right? And then it starts spreading across the country and committing acts of violence in early 1868, okay, both in Pulaski and at the same time, it starts spreading nationally as newspapers like the New York Times pick it up. Okay. Okay, so you have this Klan. It begins in 1866. It doesn't really start to commit violence until 1868, when it rapidly expands to the rest of the country through a network of newspapers. Okay, but the misconception a lot of people have about it is that the Klan is a single thing which has continued since for this 150-year period, because we still have it now, right? So it never went away. But actually, it's really important to understand that there are different iterations of the Klan, and each one is very different from the last, right? And so I'm just going to show you a couple images of the first Klan, and then I'll talk about... So the first Klan starts in 1866, picks up in 1868, and it's going to end in 1871, okay, pretty much the last. There's a couple of exceptions to this because it's a national movement. There's always going to be some guy who's like, I am a Klansman, I'm attacking someone, right? But as far as like an organized, powerful entity, the Klan ceases to exist in 1871, possibly 1872. You can make a case. There's a little bit of Klan violence in 1872. The Republicans wanted to make that case, right, because they wanted to have more control in the 1872 elections, right? So there was a certain amount of talk about the Klan in 1872, but there's no really good evidence of Klan violence after 1871. So the Klan actually is only active for a four-year period, though it's a very bloody four-year period, right? And what they're doing in this first Klan is going out and lynching people, basically, right? So there's a lot of violence where they'll go into people's homes, you know, they'll attack them, they'll drag them out of their homes, they'll either whip them or kill them, right? By shooting them or hanging them, primarily, right? So there's the, and the people that they're attacking in this first Klan are largely going to be, they're going to be Republicans, right? And so at this time, all black Southerners would be Republicans. Not all, but 90% of black Southerners would be Republicans. There's always that 10%. They're like, you know, I think I'm better off as a Democrat, right? You know, even back then, that you have, you know, some split. But most black Southerners this time are Republicans, and about 90-95% of white Southerners would have been Democrats, because that's the party that fought for Southern, you know, independence, right? They're opposed to Abraham Lincoln and, you know, Andrew Johnson gets a little complicated, but they're definitely opposed to you know, President Grant and the Reconstruction regime from the North. So when the Klan attacks in this first period, they're largely attacking Republicans, or they're entirely attacking Republicans, right? Most of the people they attack are black Republicans, but they will also attack white Republicans. There's not very many white Republicans, but if you are a white Republican living in the rural South, in an area with a Klan, you are very likely to be targeted, right? Because there's so few of you, right? So that's the first Klan, very bloody, very political. Okay, it's not all political, it gets more complicated, but, very bloody, very political, and it ends in 1871. And these are some of the Klan costumes from this period. I'm not going to talk all that much about costumes right now. My book talks more about costumes, but the Klan looked a little different than what we think of today, right? So they're not wearing uniforms, right? Which is significant. They just came out of a war, right? They're not wearing uniforms. They're wearing costumes, and their costumes are usually different from each other. So different people in a group would wear costumes that had some connection to each other, but they weren't like making the same costumes and they all looked the same, right? They weren't uniforms with like ranks and things like that, like later ones will be. Okay, so this is just a interesting thing that was found in the Schomburg Center, the Schomburg Collection of African American History, recently, one of my friends found it 2 years ago. She's like, I think this is a Klan costume. And it was filed as a Klan costume. It may have been a Klan costume. It may have been somebody dressing up for Halloween, for a carnival, right, for a Mardi Gras kind of party that they had, for a dress ball. It may have been somebody dressing up as a Klansman for a dress ball. That was very common in the North at the time. So either it's a Klan costume or it's somebody trying to look like it's a Klan costume. And this is probably the weirdest of the Klan costumes. But just to point out, the Klan costumes were not the same from place to place. Sometimes they did have the pointy hats, like we think about today. But they were also, particularly in the Carolinas, they tended to have these horns on their costumes, which incidentally has Caribbean roots, so it gets really complicated, right? What they're doing, they're evoking Caribbean festival costumes for their attacks on African Americans and their allies. Okay, but that Klan ends in 1871, arguably 1872. Okay. What brings it back? What brings it back is Birth of a Nation, right? Birth of a Nation is a major film in 1915 by D.W. Griffith, very well-connected. D.W. Griffith, you know, a brilliant filmmaker. Most people think it's a brilliant film, right? You know, the extremely racist film. And this film is based on a book by Thomas Dixon called The Klansman. Thomas Dixon went to graduate school with Woodrow Wilson at Johns Hopkins, my own institution, in history. And so when D.W. Griffith did a take on the book The Klansman, which sort of tried to celebrate the valor and bravery and manhood of the Klansmen of the 1860s and 1870s. President Wilson supported it, screened it in the White House, you know, and it got all sorts of popular support. It showed up all over the country. It was filmed all over the country, or, you know, screened all over the country. There were riots around it. The NAACP, which was new at the time, protested against it. You know, all sorts of people tried to, you know, say that this was not going to be helpful. But ultimately, this movie didn't immediately start the second Klan, but about 5 years, it got popular interest back to the Klan. About 5 years later, some business people basically decided they could make some money through the Klan, right? And so what they did was they set up a second Klan, which was a pyramid scheme where you had to pay your money into this, you know, the central office. Actually, there were some competing clans that were suing each other, you know. They're like, but people made an awful lot of money setting up the second Klan. They're selling uniforms. They're manufacturing uniforms in mass and selling them at a profit. And you have to change your uniform and you get up to a new level in the Klan hierarchy. And basically it's after like a Masonic model or something like that. Okay, that's the second Klan. This Klan is very, very different from the first Klan. Remember, and it's been decades since the first Klan ended, right? The second Klan evokes the first Klan. It pretends to be a continuation of the first Klan. It wants to revive the first Klan, but it has no biological connection, or like, you know, it's none of the same people, right, are in the first Klan and the second Klan. They'd be dead, right? But they, you know, you don't have any sort of continuity between the two groups that anybody has been able to discover. So the second Klan, you can see them here marching down Pennsylvania Avenue. The second Klan is popular enough at the time that major political figures throughout the early to mid 1920s, when the second Klan ended, right, major political figures endorsed it. Governors of states like Colorado were supported by the Klan and themselves acknowledged support by the Klan and, you know, affiliation with the Klan. When the Klan marched in Washington, D.C., the question was, is Coolidge going to come out and address us or not? And that was in the New York Times. Will he come out and, you know, say some words to the Klan? And ultimately he decided not to, but it was like an open question. Might that happen? He had to think about it, right? So it was a very mainstream. It was huge. This was by far the largest Klan. The first Klan, we don't know how many people was in it because it was illegal and surreptitious and whatever, but the first Klan was probably 1/100th the size of the second Klan. The second Klan, when people come up to me and say, my grandfather was in the Klan, right? They always mean the second Klan. Everybody's grandfather was in the second Klan. You know, not everybody, but, you know, an awful lot of people who were white and not Catholic and not Jewish, and not like Hungarian or some sort of like, you know, undesirable immigrant. If you were, a Presbyterian white, a respectable man, or, you know, Episcopalian or, whatever, it would be very normal to be in the Klan. That wouldn't mean you were necessarily advocating violence. It would just mean that you thought white people were better and that you thought we should acknowledge that. And that's what everybody thought. I mean, that's what all the powerful people thought, right? So it was a very racist position, but it was a very mainstream position. So I'm sure that, like, when was this church founded? Okay. If this, a church like this, I should have known that. But a church like this would have been, holding Klan meetings, something like that had it been around at that time. So it's a very different kind of Klan, though, to evoke the first one. Okay. The third Klan is the... then the Klan goes away in the mid-1920s. There's major sex scandals, and there's major business scandals. The Klan leaders are fighting for each other over the profits, and that gets into the papers and makes them look bad. And then also one of the Klan leaders, tortured to death his girlfriend, in a particularly grotesque way. And so that cast a pall upon the Klan. So that went away, and then the third Klan starts really in the 1950s, 1960s, opposed to the civil rights movement. And that's where some people might have a memory of seeing some of this on the television, right? Or, in the newspapers. That one's always going to be less organized. The second one is more organized because it has the bureaucratic, commercial stuff going on. This third Klan, again, it's going to be a whole bunch of different, everybody's a grand wizard, kind of thing. And that's going to be, very different. They do wear the costumes, right? But they don't always wear the costumes. They're just as likely to wear the white T-shirts and the jeans. And now we have, ever since then, and we could call this a continuation, because that third Klan never really went away, though it became almost entirely... dead. You didn't hear about the Klan very much in the 80s, though occasionally something would peek up. Well, there was David Duke, right, down in Louisiana. But now we seem to maybe be having a resurgence. Well, we are having a resurgence. We don't know how far it's going to go. This is a Klan rally I was actually at last summer, but this isn't my picture. This is down in Columbia, South Carolina, last summer, and it was, a Klan rally at the State House, and you could see that the folks you see up front are protesting the Klan rally. That's the picture. But if you can see down, you can't really see them too well. But a bunch of guys marching down at the bottom. What's interesting about this Klan is that it's really merged with the Nazis in a way that hadn't been the case with prior Klans. They stood for different things, right? But now there seems to be a merger. Okay, so we have a whole bunch of different Klans, and that's the first that took longer than I was thinking it would. But, myth two, the Klan was a centralized organization with a single leader. And some people probably recognize, here we go. The Klan was a centralized organization with a single leader. I'll go through that pretty quickly. The first Klan did not have a central leadership. That was significant. Okay, there were definitely people who thought up the Klan and who started the Klan in Pulaski, but those people didn't continue to try to run the Klan afterwards, right? So they came up with the idea. The idea circulated through newspapers. The way that people would start a Klan then was they would read the newspapers. They would say, I want white people to be in charge in this area. I don't think black people should have that land over there. I don't want black people voting in the election. There's this idea of the Klan that I read about in the newspaper. That sounds like a good idea. My friends and I maybe have already been attacking black people who are competing with us. We're going to call ourselves the Klan. We're going to put on a costume, right? Or we're going to start using violence we hadn't used before. But they didn't have any way to get in touch with the people in Tennessee who started it. Like, there wasn't any sort of organizational mechanism that they could do that. It was illegal, it was surreptitious, communication was difficult, right? So people think about the Klan as a single thing, but it's really important, I think, to realize that that was kind of true in the second Klan, that it was a single thing, though there was all these competing groups. But you know, there was much more centralized in the second Klan. In the first Klan, and then in the third Klan, and in today's Klan, there's no Grand Dragon, right, that matters, right? It's much more a spread out movement. It's like always trying to kill the top person in Al-Qaeda or something like that. It's like, well, maybe, you know, but there's a whole bunch of people who call themselves Al-Qaeda who don't have any way to get in touch with, you know, the central people in Al-Qaeda, right? People, they come up with an Al-Qaeda group because they're sympathetic to what they think Al-Qaeda stands for, right? And then maybe they're able to get in touch with some central organization, but probably not. So it's not centralized. And one thing that's really important about that is that the government, when the federal government tried to approach it as centralized in the Reconstruction era, they're like, well, we need to find out who's in charge of this and we need to bring it down. And they tried to do that for a couple of years and it really wasn't very effective. You know, what finally worked was they had to work from the local level, right? And they had to be like, well, we're going to go into this county where there's a lot of Klan violence and we're going to kind of carpet it with people and we're going to, you know, arrest hundreds of people and we're going to stop the organization that way. But it never worked when they're like, we're going to figure out who's running this and we're going to stop it, because it just wasn't centralized like that. Okay, the myth three, and this connects to that. Nathan Bedford Forrest was an important early leader of the Klan. I think when people think about the Klan, the first thing that a lot of people think about, the one thing you know about the Klan, is that it was led by this guy, Nathan Bedford Forrest, right? Nathan Bedford Forrest, if you're not a Civil War buff, you probably actually don't even know Nathan Bedford Forrest was, but he's a really popular among people who work on the Civil War, and particularly people who are more pro-Confederate, right, are really often into Nathan Bedford Forrest. But he was a cavalry leader, and apparently, by all accounts, a very effective cavalry leader in the Civil War. And then he went on to become a popular figure after the Civil War. And a lot of people at the time thought that he was the head of the Klan. And he himself more or less claimed to be the head of the Klan. You know, he was interviewed by Congress. He was interrogated by Congress about the question of whether he was head of the Klan. And he was cagey. He was like, well, you know, these things have to stop. Like, you know, as long as you keep on supporting this illegitimate power of black people in the South, there's going to be a Klan. And like, you know, so he was really, he wouldn't take direct credit for it. But he wanted people to think, you know, that he was running the Klan, right? However, because of the Klan's decentralized nature, it's just impossible to imagine how he could have been realistically running the Klan. We do know he was a Klan supporter. We know he was in Memphis, where a lot of important Klan supporters were. We know he hung out with a couple of people who were important in writing pro-Klan writings. So they would they'd write novels and plays about how great the Klan was. And they were good writers, and these things would circulate, right? So he was, like, in a circle that I would call Klan intellectuals, right, in Memphis, who were, like, Southern nationalists who supported the Klan. He was in that group. Was he named a Grand Dragon by that group? Maybe, right? Why not, right? Why wouldn't they have done that? They could have done that. But did he have any effective means to communicate with a Klan, with a group that's attacking black people in rural South Carolina? There's no evidence that he did. I feel very strongly that he did not. That's something that's a little bit, somebody's going to argue otherwise. There's going to be a book coming out in about 2 years that will take the opposite position. But I'm going to say no, yeah. Okay. Myth four. The Ku Klux Klan is Southern, right? And the first Klan, yes, the first Klan was definitely Southern, though occasionally people would say, oh, there's a Klan up in Massachusetts, you know, oh, there's a Klan, you know, in Iowa, you know, somebody was Ku Kluxed in, you know, Wisconsin, you know, that came out in the newspapers. And people would dress up as Klansmen and attack people in the North, you know, occasionally, right? But it was very sporadic. There's no evidence there was any sort of organized Klan, right, up in the North, other than just people taking the idea. There were a lot of, like, fun Klans, like, in the North. Like people would say, oh, I think the Klan is cool. I like their costumes. I'm going to dress up as a Klansman for, you know, a carnival. There were, like, baseball teams up in the North that would call themselves the Ku Klux Klan baseball team. There was Yale University had an eating club that was called the Ku Klux at the time that there was a Klan. Like, it was very, like, mainstream, right? There'd be, like, advertisements. It would be, like, you know, buy Ku Klux sheets or, you know, blankets, like the whitest, cleanest, you know, sheets and blankets of the South, you know, be like, there would be that kind of thing. But that was big in the North. But there was not really Klan. A first Klan was definitely in the South. The second Klan, right, which you talked about, that's the one that was up here a lot. And in fact, the second Klan is started in Indiana. And is mainly housed, like, it's more popular up in the North than it is down in the South. It was really big in Pennsylvania, right? And it was big in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh had a very substantial second Klan, but so did every place else. Like, I used to teach at Oshkosh, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. I went down to their archive and found a picture of the Klansmen parading through the main street, Oshkosh, right? So it's just like everywhere there was a Klan, because the Klan stood for white supremacy, and white people were white supremacists, right, as we headed up to World War II. Let's see. So here's Ku Klux Klan threaten race in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's a weird title, but this is an article from the Cleveland Advocate about how black people in Pittsburgh are afraid of a Klan race. I probably meant to say race riot in Pittsburgh. But so we definitely had that. One thing I've discovered is that the Knights of Columbus, which is awesome for me because I teach at Duquesne and there's an active Knights of Columbus chapter. Knights of Columbus would go out and rumble with the Klan. They would go, like, they would fight with the Klan, and that was in the newspapers. And in one case, they took some of their costumes and ran off with them. So I was like, I told the Knights of Columbus, like, that is as cool as you've ever been. Like, that moment was like the height of the Knights of Columbus. But yeah. So yeah, there's definitely a Klan in this area. The subsequent clans, like after that, the clans in the 1950s and 1960s, okay, they're going to be mainly in the South, where you have most of the civil rights protests going on, but there's definitely going to be active clans up in Pittsburgh at that time as well, right? There's going to be rallies up here, right? And there's going to be occasional acts of Klan violence, particularly in rural areas around here in the 1950s and the 1960s. So there is an active Klan in the 1950s and 60s. And this continues at a low level through the 70s and 80s. And I don't know if you guys have noticed in the papers in the last couple of years, there have been a couple of Klan scares in Pittsburgh. Just little things like flyers up or, like, you know, that kind of stuff. But in the past couple of years, the Post-Gazette has had a couple of stories about Klan threats in Pittsburgh. People are aware of that. I don't think there's anything organized or substantial in this area. I think it's still pranking. But it would be, you know, it wouldn't be too surprising if something wasn't organized here pretty soon. Possibly. Let's see. Okay, and the last myth I wanted to talk about was that the idea that the Ku Klux Klan's victims were rarely able to fight back effectively, right? Because I think, and maybe that's the most important thing I wanted to mention, the Klan, you know, has come and gone many times, And one of the reasons it's come and gone is that people have been able to shut it down, right? I guess I want to say two things. And the first thing is that people who've been victims of the Klan have often been able to marshal political power, you know, and find, you know, use the power of the state, right, to help them shut down the Klan. That certainly was the case in the late 1860s, early 1870s, because Republicans were in power, right, because they had the presidency and Congress, and because they relied upon black votes in the South, the victims of the Klan were able to effectively, you know, marshal the power of the state to suppress the Klan. And they did it deliberately. You know, they would write and say, you know, you need to shut this down or you can't have our support. We won't be able to get to the polls, right? So they were able to, victims of the Klan were very canny about making political alliances and demanding protection from the Klan in this earlier period. And the same is true for later periods. The other thing I wanted to say is that even on an individual level, even when the state wasn't available to help or wasn't willing to help, like in the South, during the first Klan, a lot of local governments were controlled by Democrats, right? And even some state governments pretty early on came to be functionally controlled by Democrats, right? So there wasn't too much help from those levels, and the federal government's ability to help was often really compromised because politically it didn't want to be reoccupying the South. It was nervous about being perceived as being tyrannical and stuff like that. But often, left without access to government resources, victims of Klan attacks, or people who the Klan would like to attack, were in fact able to protect themselves. You had a lot of people who gathered in self-defense groups, armed themselves in some cases, were able to arm themselves, had access to guns, were able to arm themselves, and were able to gather information about what the Klan was likely to do next, what the Klan was planning. They had allies who would give them information, and they would be able to arm themselves and fight off a Klan attack, right? Those things are less likely to make certain kinds of newspapers, right? To the extent that the Democrats controlled the press in the South, which they largely did, right? Because the people with the money in the South were Democrats, right? And so the Democrats largely controlled the press. So where the Republicans had victories against the Klan, where, you know, black victims or their white allies stood up effectively against them, that was less likely to be talked about in the newspapers, right? But we do know that, that this happened, that there was effective pushback, sometimes militarily or violently, against the Klan. We know that individuals who are attacked often fought back very effectively against the Klan. But the thing that I've been most struck by is we know that there were some people who the Klan couldn't attack. You know, who when you look at, when you really look at a close community study, you say, who would the Klan want to attack in this area? Like, who, you know, there's some clear targets that the Klan would want to, and there, some of them never get attacked, right? And that there was the ability of some people to be effective enough at projecting their self-defense that they were able to, you know, push back against the possibility that the Klan could attack them. So I think that's important because I think that when we think about terrorist groups, generally, or the Klan specifically, there's the sense of helplessness of, like, you know, like nobody can ever really defeat them because you can't expect them, and like you can't, you know, there's no steps you can take against them. But it's always been the case that, as deadly as the Klan often was, that a lot of people were very effective at preventing themselves from being attacked, using either personal defense or mobilizing the state to do that. And so that black people and others who the Klan were attacking were not necessarily always passive victims. And I think it's important to bear that in mind in the story. And they always won. Like, you know, the Klan in the end was always crushed, you know, within a couple of years. And most of the time the level of Klan violence in history has been almost, you know, almost nothing. So the Klan rises, it commits great violence for a couple of years, right? And then it's crushed again. So I think it's important that people don't feel sort of like helpless or think about the victims of the Klan as being sort of helpless in front of them in a general way. So, okay, well, I wanted to leave a little bit of time for questions, but I guess I will stop with this now. Yes.
In the headline of the Pittsburgh newspaper.
Yes.
Clue.
Yeah.
So was there significance to that?
Yeah. There's a bunch of different variant spellings of the Klan, right? So the initial people who set it up called it Ku Klux, K-U-K-L-U-X, right? But it was very common, even in the Reconstruction era, to stick an L in there and call it Ku Klux. So it wasn't, because it was disorganized, and I think it was largely people talked about it rather than reading about it in some cases, right? But some people stuck that L in there. I have not found, like, a particular group who favored the L, but it's been common since the Reconstruction era to sometimes put that L in there. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the name, it's hard to pin down exactly what the origination of the name is, and the reason is that the six people who apparently started it, right, all of them love to lie. And they lied jubilantly. They were having a really good time, right? They were people who liked to write, and they liked to write tall tales, right? And so particularly this newspaper editor, Frank McCord, had all sorts of stories, right? And he had stories of a man whose hat, you know, went all the way up to the sky and you couldn't see the top of it, right? And he wrote that with a straight face about, like, the first Klan parade. Right? Or he would write about a man who kept a lantern in his head, in his hat, so his hat glowed, right? You know, like these kind of stories that, in fact, when you think about them, it's like, no, that actually, you know, could not have occurred. But he wrote them completely straight with no indication that it was a joke, kind of like a Mark Twain, you know, a little proto Mark Twain style is what they're writing in, right? So all of them go out and tell stories about how they got the name. And all of them tell different stories. So they're doing it because they think it's great fun, right? And the name, however, that most people think is the origin that most people think is accurate, and I also think is accurate, is kuklos, is the Greek term, apparently, for circle. These very highly educated 19th century men knew Greek, and in fact used a lot of Greek in writing their constitution, their prescript. So they knew Greek and Latin, and they were using that to show their learning. So one of the stories was Ku Klux meant circle, so we adapted it into minstrel speak. So we took Ku Klux this, and we said, how would, like, you know, a minstrel-esque black person say Ku Klux, right? They would say Ku Klux. And so it was like this combination of learning and mockery. So I think that's the generally accepted story for it. But it's also the sound that a shotgun makes, like when you, whatever you do with it. Kukulkan was a Mexican god that some people in the area, a lot of them had gone to fight in the Mexican War, so it could be named after Kukulkan. You know, but there's various other stories, but I think the first one's true. So, how many? The authorities were not interested in killing them. The authorities actually weren't even really interested in imprisoning them. What happened, the federal government, of course, they were still under, they're still under Reconstruction, right, at this time. And so there were troops available to be stationed down in the South. And sometimes they were, though Grant really didn't want to send troops down in the South unless he was invited to do so by the state governor because he was worried about being perceived to be a tyrant. In fact, he was worried about federal power and state power, right, and how that worked, right? But so there was a limited number of troops that were sent down during this period to suppress the Klan. And when they got down, they were under really strict orders to, like, only, you know, move when they've been instructed from the very top to move. And so it was really hard for them to be effective. Mainly there were troops down there. They were in a camp right outside of the town, and they would stay there, right? And they wouldn't go out unless they're given specific instructions to go out and get this person, right? That said, there was a period in 1871 when the federal troops started arresting lots of people in conjunction with state authorities. And they arrested, nobody's done a full count of who they've arrested, but they arrested in some of the worst areas, like Union County, where I focused on, they arrested hundreds of people. So probably 300 people, 200, 300 people in Union County. And so in the most active areas, they'd arrest hundreds of people. Probably on the whole, they arrested maybe 2,000, 3,000, you know, something like that. Mainly, they would arrest them, get information from them, and let them go, right? Some of them were tried. Some of them pled guilty and turned state's evidence. But ultimately, basically, by the time Grant won re-election in 1872, he was trying to bring about reconciliation between Southern and Northern whites. And one way that he expressed that reconciliation is he pardoned almost all the Ku Klux arrestees, right? So the very small number of Ku Klux arrestees who were actually imprisoned, convicted and imprisoned, served about a year, and then they were pardoned. And not only were they pardoned, but there were all these like newspaper stories about, oh, it's so hard for them in the prison. They're given bad coffee. The prisons aren't clean enough. You know, they have the og. You know, it's just like, it was like everybody was really, even Northern whites were really uncomfortable with the Ku Klux being arrested, and they were very quickly let go as part of the reconciliation process. Yeah. So the first Klan, a lot of times they would have to obscure their faces because there was a federal government which, at least for all they knew, was seriously interested in arresting them, right? You know, is making gestures towards arresting people anyway. So the first Klan, yes. The second Klan, they're not committing so much violence, the second Klan, right? The second Klan is, they didn't have to because the state was super racist, you know? So, I mean, they, like, you know, they control, when you control the formal government, you don't need to do your own violence, right? That's like a benefit, right, of controlling the formal government. So the second Klan didn't really go out and do lynchings, right? They had, like, you know, they burned crosses, you know, and things like that. They had bigger rallies. They were angry about textbooks. You know, the second Klan is like, oh, the textbook is like not positive enough about the Confederacy. Like, it was all the politics that are familiar to us today. But, you know, they were going out like calling for eugenics and like calling for, you know, things like that. But it was much more like they were doing political things. Occasionally there were attacks by people who were Klansmen. But they didn't have any need to cover their face, right? The third Klan, when they would attack, they wouldn't attack in costume either, right? They just attacked people, right? Like the third Klan, think about the civil rights era. They're not so much attacking people wearing a funky, you know, like a Klan outfit. They're attacking people wearing their t-shirt and their jeans, and they're like killing them, right? Or, you know, they're not, or they're comfortable that the Southern juries aren't going to convict them, so it doesn't matter. Who knows whether they're there? If you think about it, like lynch mobs in the late 19th century, early 20th century aren't covering their faces because there's no danger of arrest, right? Yeah. So it's like, so that's really like the first client is the one that has to cover their faces. And then occasionally, like if you're having a meeting, like if you're having like a meeting like in the 70s or the 80s and you want to say, we're really important and we're really up to something, right? Then you might cover your face to show, in the same way that like today, like anarchists who go out to rallies or something like that, they might cover their face and it, because it makes them look more menacing, like maybe they're not really planning to do anything, but they look like they might be planning to do something because they have their face covered. So occasionally, like, you know, the Klan's people now will like cover their faces at a rally or something, but it's kind of to evoke their potential for violence rather than while they're doing violence. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, so the first Klan, that's a really good question, and I'm not going to have a good answer to it because I've thought about this, right? The first Klan, I haven't found strong objection stated by Southern churches except for Black churches, right? So some of the targets of the first Klan were ministers. Okay, so that would be basically people who were community leaders were in the Black community were likely to be targeted. So several of the people who were attacked by the Klan were ministers, right? So you had churches, and one reason why they'd be attacked is that they were condemning the Klan in their sermons, right? So you had particularly Black ministers using that community organization of the church, right, to condemn the Klan. I don't have any stories of white ministers having that issue or doing that, which doesn't mean it didn't happen. Though if it had happened a lot, I definitely would have heard about it because I've read so much, you know, in the period. So I don't think that was a big thing in the South, right? You know, Northern organizations were sending down missionaries to the South during the Reconstruction period. So were all these, like, Northern young white women down here teaching schools. Some of them were being attacked by the Klan. Right, so missionary organizations, and presumably also at that time their denominations would be protesting Klan violence against these like young white female missionaries, which mainly was to drive them out. Right, they'd be like, "You get out of town." Yeah, so there wasn't a real strong church voice in the first Klan against the first Klan. In subsequent Klans, yes, definitely that was a big thing. Everybody knows, like, in the 50s and 60s. In the second Klan, I would like to think that that would have been a big thing, but I kind of doubt it because it was so mainstream that, you know, the Catholics certainly were opposed to it because the Klan was anti-Catholic in the 20s, though it wasn't earlier, right? The, you know, Jewish community was definitely opposed to it because the Klan was opposed to them. But there wasn't, and I'm sure that there were some voices from Protestants as well, but I haven't studied the second Klan enough that I would have come across them. So, yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. In particular, I can speak best to the first Klan, though I think it's very different, you know. The kind of person and the kind of things they're doing is actually very different in each of the clans. But the first Klan, you know, I talked about how these guys were pretty, like, you know, the other things. Like, I didn't even talk about this. Like, women's rights advocates. Like, there's all sorts of, like, mind-blowing things about these people who are, like... the people in Pulaski don't end up committing the violence so much, right? There's a couple of exceptions to that. Generally speaking, they come up with this idea of the Klan, and then it spreads, right? And where it spreads, it largely spreads to groups of... it's going to be different in each community. Different people can pick it up in each community. But the community I focused on, it ended up being like a gang in Union County, South Carolina. And this gang had always been attacking people, you know, hitting women with chairs. You know, they're just like, there's a big record of like, you know, this gang just going out, and they were running the a lot of the prostitution, and they were running the moonshining and stuff like that, right? A lot of gambling. And so they were just like the vice people, and they were also just like always stabbing each other, you know. And those are the guys, they're like, we're going to call each other, we're going to call ourselves the Klan now, and we're going to focus, you know, on these particular kind of victim, right? And then we'll have more public support, right, for what we're doing. So this was kind of a way that the thugs in the community could sort of get legitimacy after the war. So yeah, so it's not that like it was like these fine, you know, individuals who were becoming Klansmen. It was, yeah, I think so. And then, like, as far as these guys who were kind of more upper class people in Pulaski, I do think part of what was going on with them was that their whole society had collapsed. They're like in their late 20s, early 30s, and they're supposed to be starting their lives, and like, you know, there's no jobs, and you know, there's no money, and there's no future. And I think that that's part of what's going on, this kind of, yeah, frustration. Yeah. Right.
The second one, definitely, elitist and
intellectual. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it doesn't, I think that far from legitimizing it, it makes us question the idea that elite intellectuals are legitimate. You know, so I think that's kind of the position that I'm coming from, is that it's not that it's like, oh, like there were these, you know, fine people who were fighting against it and this other, but it's like the Yale people were like, oh, the Klan's kind of cool. You know, so it's like up to the very top of society, there was this kind of sickness as well. And it was this kind of, you know, the Klan ends up being this sort of interesting combination between the people at the very top of society and these kind of thugs. You know, we're like, well, actually, we could use a little bit of that violence right now because we're feeling threatened by, you know, free African Americans. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And so there's this kind of, and we don't have to necessarily get our own hands dirty, right? But, you know, I think of the 1920s, what's happening is you have the Great Migration, you know, a lot of black people coming up getting jobs in the North. It's a threat, right? Civil rights, they, you know, as black people wanted to have a little bit, a share, you know, of the resources. And it's the same thing. I mean, all of the Klan periods have been at times when there was a large movement among African Americans to lay claim to rights and resources that they had been denied. And so this is like this moment when thugs who have always been doing that kind of thing get some sort of public support, newspaper attention, and resources from elites in order to do some of their violence, I think. Sorry, this is so dark. I'm like, why do I work on this? Yeah. Those people definitely felt very intimidated by these threats, you know, yeah. And I think, I mean, the other thing that's really interesting that I hadn't a chance to talk too much about, but is the relationship between, you know, how terrorism works is there's only a small number of acts. Most people are actually not in danger at all, right? You know, even in the first Klan, which was by far the most violent, most people, never got affected. You know, in most communities in the South, there wasn't a Klan. Even if you lived in the rural South, there wasn't a Klan in your community most places, right? Virginia never had Klans. You know, Florida had very limited Klans, you know, in different areas. Areas where cities never had Klans. Areas where black people were in the majority, which was true of, like, you know, some parts of South Carolina, they never had Klans, right? But terrorism was such that you have the feeling that at any moment it could be you next, right? So it's like the connection between what actually happens and the media's willingness to, like, spread this, like, atmosphere of terror. Yeah. So. Anything else? Like, okay. Well, thank everybody very much. This was really interesting. And if anybody wants, I have my books up here. If anybody wants to buy a copy of my book. And I have told David that I'd send him a link to this BBC Scotland thing. I don't know how long it takes him to edit or anything like that, but hopefully not too long, because I want to see it too. So, okay. Okay, thank you very much.